CatRackCoach.com podcast series, episode number 165, with Dr. Jonathan Wolfson, climbing the ladder of life and building an ophthalmology empire. You're going to learn a lot.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest. That's Dr. Jonathan Wolfson from the Wolfson Eye Institute there in Atlanta, and now also Tennessee and North Carolina and Alabama. I got to learn all these secrets. Welcome to our podcast, Jonathan.
Hi, good to see you again today.
Now, you have an incredibly interesting background. I had a chance to spend some time with you recently in South Africa, and I love chatting with you. You got to tell us your journey, especially how do you ended up from getting into ophthalmology? But what's the whole path?
Oh, boy. Do you want the 30-second version or the three-minute version?
I'll take whatever you got. We can do three minutes. It's so fascinating.
Okay. So I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Zimbabwe, which used to be called Rhodesia. And they had a lot of political turmoil, and I moved to South Africa with my family at the end of 1978. So that's really dating us. I was 14 years old, and we were essentially refugees because everything we owned was pretty much taken over by the government. And I went to go live with family in South Africa, finished off high school there, and finished high school when I was 17, and I was a tennis player.
Okay.
And that was my ticket. And it was actually more than that for me at the time, because I had no intentions of doing anything academic. I didn't really study much in high school, and I just knew 100% for sure that I was going to be a tennis player. And I had half a dozen or more scholarship offers in the U.S. to go to a college. And my father convinced me to go to Vanderbilt, thinking that it'd be good to have an education, just in the one in a million chance that I wasn't a professional tennis player, right?
Well, Vanderbilt's a great school. Wow.
Vanderbilt's it's a decent academic school, and it's a good, you know, they had a decent tennis program there. It's actually a lot better now on the tennis front. And so I went there, played some tennis there for a little bit, and very quickly decided that I was going to give up the tennis and try and do something academic. Okay. And so I gave up my tennis scholarship. I was not American, so I didn't qualify for any of the federal, state, and a lot of the school loans.
Sure.
And so another school in Tennessee called Swanee gave me an opportunity there, and I interviewed there for a couple of days, and they gave me, I don't know why, to this day, I don't know how they made that decision, but on the spot in May, because I started in January. Our school year in Africa ends December. I started college in January. And by that May, I decided, boy, I want to get out and do something different. Swanee offered me an academic scholarship with like no background. I don't know how they made that decision. And I went there and I studied, and I was a math major, and I very nearly became an actuary. But they ran their own ambulance department, and it was really cool. So you became an EMT, and you felt very, very important carrying around a little beeper, right? And then the beeper would go off, and even if you're in the middle of a lecture or even an exam, you go. And so we did the EMT thing, and I loved it. And I decided very late on that I was going to do medicine. And I stayed as a math major, graduated as a math major. I just loved math. It came really easy to me. And decided to do medicine. I went back to Vanderbilt for medical school. And I took a couple of summer schools. And so I was pretty young. I was 20 when I graduated college. And went to med school at Vanderbilt and loved just about everything. I loved neurosurgery, interventional radiology. I was looking at oculoplastics, and I applied to all of them at the same time. And ophthalmology was an early match. I only applied to a couple places, which is kind of stupid. Emory offered me a position, and I did my ophthalmology training at Emory. Was not really into the clinical side of things. I really wanted to be a surgeon. And sure. So I really kind of struggled the first couple of years. Then once, you know, the third year, once we were in the OR, because Emory was very backloaded. The first 2 years, you did almost no surgery. Mm-hmm. You just got a few cataracts at the end of your second year. And in the third year, once we got to surgery, then I really found the passion for ophthalmology. And I did that. And I liked a lot of different subspecialties, and I ended up thinking about retina, and I went back to Africa to get a lot of surgical retina training with a guy there, because they were doing a lot of retina. There were very few retina trained people in Africa. as you know, because you were there, the general guys do everything. So the general guys will do, they'll do glaucoma tubes, and they'll do vitrectomies, and they'll do cataracts, and they'll do LASIK, and they'll do everything. And so there was one guy there that was a pure retina guy, Louis Kruger. And I was with him, and I was learning retina. And he said to me one day, hey, you need to go check out my buddy, Kiel Kritzinger. So this was like 1994. Right. I'd been exposed to PRK under FDA trials at Emory, but no one was doing LASIK in the US.
Right. Not in 1994, for sure.
And, and so Kiel Kritzinger had a old Chiron laser, and I went and saw his results, and I just fell in love with LASIK right away. So I stayed there until end of 95 when it got approved in the US, and I came back the next week.
Wow. And
ended up working with TLC. Remember TLC?
Sure.
And we were one of the first clinics actually in Greenville, South Carolina. And we built that up. And then a couple years later, I thought I would just stay with him for a year or two, really hone the skills and learn the business side of it all. And I had an opportunity to take over a laser in Atlanta because some guys had bought it and they didn't really know a lot about LASIK. But I made the decision to stay with TLC, and I thought that would be my whole career. And so I cut a deal with them, and I was their surgeon in three different cities. And we built it up beautifully. I mean, at one point I was doing a lot of surgery. It just seems crazy now to think about it. I mean, like at one point we were doing like nearly 1,000 eyes a month.
All right? Wow.
And to this day, I still don't even know exactly why. I mean, we were just about to sign a long-term contract, and I got a call from my lawyer, and she said, like, sit down. You're not going to believe this. They're terminating you. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Wow.
Because we weren't having any contractual terrible disputes, or I thought everything was done. And I think someone got in their ear that they could get it done cheaper or not share the profits or whatever. I don't even know what it was. But so they terminated me, and I just all of a sudden was on my own. At that point, we were getting referrals from a 200-mile radius.
Wow.
When we were in Atlanta there, we were getting from like all the way from Knoxville, Chattanooga, Birmingham, you know, northern part of Florida. And I was saying to them, we need to put a satellites in each of those cities. So we didn't go to areas that were cold. We didn't say, I'm going to open up somewhere in California or even Alabama that we don't have anything there. We already had a base of doctors. We were doing lectures there. And so when we split, I just put little satellite offices in each of the cities. And for a long time, we did just pure LASIK in those offices because the volume was really good and it was fun. But I realized at some point that it could be volatile. And I think we've seen that now. We started introducing cataract surgeons in Atlanta first and then in the other places. So now we have cataract doctors and other doctors in most of the other centers. So in Atlanta, we have a couple of glaucoma doctors, a couple of retina doctors, we've got plastics, and half a dozen cornea cataract doctors as well.
So you got the full spectrum now of all ophthalmic care, basically.
Yeah, so it's worked out really well, and we're trying now to really incorporate everyone. Everyone's under our banner. We've got one surgery center. We're just about to open up a second one, and now I made a real bet about 5 or 6 years ago or more. That I thought OBS would be the future for cataract surgery.
Right.
And I think directionally I was correct, but timing-wise I was horribly wrong.
Right.
And just like in the stock market, that makes you horribly wrong, even if directionally you're right, right? And so we've just been waiting for the approval, but we just got word really in the last couple of weeks, actually since I saw you, that some of the insurance companies are going to start approving a facility fee for office-based surgery as long as you have some level of credentialing, and I'm sure they'll have their own standards and stuff. So I do think it's that wall is starting to crack.
Right.
And certainly when you see the numbers that came out of Kaiser with, I think they had 300,000 cases with, good results, safety profile was good, results profile was good. And I think that's really going to be the future of cataract surgery.
Interesting. So the way it moved from, decades ago, hospital-based surgery to now ASC, ambulatory surgery centers for surgery, and now it's going to move towards OBS or office-based surgery.
Yeah, and I think it's going to work well for everyone because I think the patients will get a better experience because it's local. They know their doctor's office. And I think the doctors will do better because it'll make it fairly efficient. They have more control over their environment. As long as they're doing it right. I mean, there's always that provision that you got to make sure it's been run right you're running it as a real ASC and making sure you got all the safety profiles and everything's done correctly.
Right.
And then the insurance companies will be happy as well because they'll be able to have some sort of global fee that'll encompass both facility and professional fee that will be less than the toll that they're paying right now.
Right.
So right now, there's a huge variation. Like if you have an individual ASC, some ASCs will average around $1,200 facility fee. And if you're associated with a hospital, it may be a lot more than that.
Right.
Maybe even double that. And I think the insurance companies will look at that and say, man, we can save a few hundred dollars per eye times, what is it, 4 million eyes every year. Right. As a whole community. That's a lot of savings involved for the totality of it all.
No, for sure. I think that's definitely the way it's headed as well. It'll take a little bit of time, but it's probably the right move. But again, like you said, timing is everything. You got to wait for the insurers and now Medicare to approve that and pay for that. But I think
I think the guys at IOR have been, you know, ahead of that game trying to help people into that.
Right.
But I think they've always struggled with how to figure out the facility fee, especially if it's a CMS case, a Medicare case.
Right. Now, tell me about some of the mentality or the hustle involved, because to basically get told you're fired and then say, I'm going to go out on my own. I have the drive and determination and the hard work to go out on my own, and also the risk taking to now set up my own clinic, do satellites, and I'm just going to make this work.
Well, on a personal level, I don't have a huge spending problem.
Okay.
Like I never had a huge crazy house. I never had a boat or a second house or an airplane or anything like that. And so, you know, I'd made a lot of money over the first several years and I banked and invested. And so I had some seed money that I knew that I could, you know, keep a chunk off to the side and say, okay, I'm going to protect that and I'm going to be fine no matter what.
Right.
I think when you're in that situation, it gives you a little more leeway to be able to say you can afford to make some mistakes. And so one of the things I did early on that actually saved me was at one point we had 14 locations. This was before the financial crash in 08, 09, right? And at that point, we were just starting to bring on cataract doctors, but we didn't have enough of them to support the whole system without LASIK. And you know, the financial crash comes and you see a huge drop in numbers. I think nationwide, it went from a total of 1.5 million eyes all the way down to 730,000. So it was more or less about a 60% drop in volume. And then people were discounting more. So there was actually like a 70% drop in revenue. And when you have that kind of hit and it happens so quickly, you can't really manage your way out of that. If you have really high expenses, because a lot of them are fixed, right? You got your rent that's fixed.
Employees.
You can pare down the staff a little bit, but not a lot. And then you got to pay for the lasers, and you can't get away from that. You know, without your lasers, you can't do the work, right? So the thing that really put us in good stead was I had some mobile units. And in those days, it was Vizx that became AMO, which became J&J. All right. And I just had two lasers.
So roll on, roll off.
Yeah. So I hired a couple of engineers. I sent them to your part of the world in California to go get trained. And so they got the official certification training. And then I would be in one city and they would be one step ahead of me all the time. And so it was expensive to run those guys because you got to pay them and you got to pay the travel expenses. But it was a lot cheaper than paying for a bunch of lasers.
Right.
And also we knew it was calibrated correctly every day. And so when that financial crash happened, we had a little more leeway in the system because we weren't on the line for 14 different lasers.
Right.
And And if you're doing femto, it's 14 times two, right?
Right.
You get an eczema plus a femto. And we only had two of those, and we did have some femto lasers, but I was also able to do keratome work in places that didn't have femtos. And so that's kind of what saved us then. And now things have kind of morphed because, you know, the Visage J&J guys, I feel like, haven't really kept up with the technology as well. So we've moved more towards the Alcon platform.
Right, the Allegretto.
Yeah. And so there was the Allegretto, which was the 400. Now you got the 500. And we are actually able to immobilize that as well, but that's a lot more difficult. It takes better part of a day to break down and set up and everything. So we're still mobilizing, but not as much. So now we have five different lasers, and you know, we're going through a crazy downturn in the LASIK market, as everyone knows right now. Right. And for those of you who haven't heard, the numbers have gone all the way down. Last year, 2025, the numbers went down to 430,000, I think.
Wow. Wow.
And they're expecting this year to be even lower than that. It's going to be in the high 300s. So it's really like Armageddon out there. That's why there's been a couple LASIK-only places in Atlanta that shut down. I heard of two places in Nashville, Tennessee that shut down as well. One of my competitors in Chattanooga is also shutting down, which on the one hand, it sounds good because you've got less competition, but it's overall just terrible because there's just no cases out there. You know, and so it's putting a lot of strain on the system for everyone.
Well, we've learned. I mean, LASIK patients are obviously a much different age group than our cataract patients, and they're far more sensitive to fluctuations in the economy. You know, you get your average 30-year-old who's already, like, stretched thin financially, hard for them to cough up the money for LASIK. Whereas your 68-year-old or 70-year-old who's on cataract surgery, they've got a few dollars saved.
Yeah, and so I think it's, you know, the guys who involved in investing always say diversify, 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 right? Because when things are going well, no one really thinks or believes that it can go bad. And I think LASIK's just a great example of that because, you know, if you asked, you know, 3-4 years ago, could we be as low as we are now? I don't think anybody would say there's just no way. It would be impossible for it to be that low because our results have never been better. Complications have never been lower. Things are looking great. We don't have any like really bad PR stories out there that make us look really bad. I mean, there's always the odd story here and there, but there's nothing pervasive out there.
Right.
And so it's a really interesting question as to why. Like, why are the numbers so bad? I mean, you're seeing a huge drop in cosmetic dentistry and other plastic surgery as well, but not quite as much as LASIK. And LASIK's taken a huge dip. It's everyone's talking about it, and I'm not sure everyone's got the right answer for that. But it's also brought up the question I was going to ask you, and we can maybe talk about this offline a little bit. Is that, you know, I haven't done cataract for a while, and it's I've got a lot of extra time on my hands now, so I've given serious thought and made the decision to go back.
It's like riding a bike. I love it. It's like riding a bicycle.
Yeah, but I gave it up early on. I didn't, you know, I didn't do like, you know, 10,000 cataracts in my days. I just did a few hundred. So I may be asking you for some guidance in that department.
Very happy to. So it was like, well, it was interesting. You know, when I was a resident, I did my first LASIK. This is the late 1990s. And I was very lucky because I was the first resident at UCLA to be able to do LASIK because the current chairman, Ann Coleman, who's a glaucoma specialist, advocated for me to let me get LASIK done. So what an incredible person she is. But I just thought when I finished my training, I started practice in 2000. I thought, you know, it's going to be like when kids get braces when they're 13 years old. I think everyone's going to get LASIK when they're like 20. And then this is going to be a huge business. It's going to grow incredibly fast. And I was so wrong. I think that year, 2000, we hit there were more than a million LASIK done that year. But then I don't think we've matched that number since.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Historically, we always thought that the two barriers to entry were fear and money.
Right.
That people were afraid of getting surgery, afraid of a laser. And then there's obviously the financial component of it. And what's interesting, if you listen to the younger generation, and it's not just the real young ones, I mean, even people, anyone less than pretty much 35, 40 right now, I mean, they are not afraid of it. They don't have that fear aspect to it. I mean, obviously, there are some people that are afraid, but as a group, that's not the pervasive, that's not the general thought of it all. And so it's really mostly a financial issue, or there are things going on that we just don't understand. And you know, one of the things that helped us as a clinic is around 2010, we had a cornea surgeon from Emory, Dr. Stulting, who had been head of cornea at Emory for a while. And he phoned me up one day and said he wanted to come, he wanted to leave Emory and come work for me. And I was like, is this a crank call? Like, what's really going on here? Like,
right.
And but no, he came and he brought with him, you know, some of his research work. And the main part of that was that original CXL USA cross-linking study that Roy Rubenfeld had started. And I'd known Roy from early days of LASIK because he was also with TLC. Mm. He had been part of a group called 2020 that got bought out by TLC. And so we got involved on the cross-linking side. And that was one of the early times of doing epithelium on cross-linking.
Mm-hmm.
And in the immediate years prior to that, you know, from 2009, 10, 11, 12, in those years, the Europeans had tried the epithelium on cross-linking. But as you know, the cross-linking, you're putting riboflavin on and then you shine it off. But they'd used just regular riboflavin for the most part. And they were never able to get the riboflavin into the stroma. And so they had study after study after study that showed that it failed. And so there was just this overall feeling and a very clear direction that epithelium on can't be done. It doesn't work. It sucks. It's terrible. But the real key point was that they hadn't figured out how to get the riboflavin into the stroma.
Sure.
And so this wasn't my idea. It wasn't my IP. I give all the credit to Roy and his people. That they did figure that out, and they tagged the riboflavin with a few different things, a few different molecules, and that were able to get the ribo into the cornea, into the stroma. And we're able to show it because they actually, before we apply the light, we actually take the patients to the slit lamp, look at the eye, look at the stroma, and then we grade it from 1 to 5.
Okay.
In terms of how much riboflavin, okay, what concentration of riboflavin is in the stroma. And we do that before we actually put the light on there.
Wow.
So that was the protocol. And so then you know for sure that not only is ribo getting in, but enough ribo is getting in.
Right.
And then you're putting the light on, and the light was also a little bit different. It was a little bit more light. It was alternating on and off, and the timetable is a little bit different as well. And then we showed that it really worked, and we presented that in like 2019 at the Zurich Crosslinking International Crosslinking Experts meeting. And we were resoundingly laughed off the stage and shooed off the stage because they were so convinced that it really didn't work. And the study had its own set of issues.
Sure.
Because there was no good control group, and we weren't showing good progression before getting into the group. There were several issues in the study that were legitimate, criticisms of the study. But the one thing that got my attention, and should have got everyone's attention, was that we had 39 pediatric eyes.
Oh, interesting.
And after 2 years, none of them progressed.
Wow, okay, that's very interesting.
And there was pretty good data even at that time that showed that about a little under 90% of the pediatric eyes were progressing in 1 year.
Sure.
And so they have 39 of them, and none of them progressing over a couple of years. And now we've been following some of those for longer, and they've done very well. And so that was the data that I was presenting in at the South African Congress of Cataract Refractive Surgery, was the long-term data, because we're calling in those patients from 15 and 14 and 13 years ago.
Right.
And bringing them in, and we're still seeing that they're very stable. You know, over the first few years, there's 0.5% of retreatment, and over the long term, it's a little bit more than that, but it's still stable at below 2%.
Well, it's fantastic. You have such a long follow-up now, more than 10 years.
Yeah, but it's amazing how much people move. It's so difficult getting those patients back in.
Oh, for sure, for long-term follow-up?
Yeah,
there's so few of these studies.
Yeah, I mean, I started this like 6-8 months ago, really putting a real effort trying to get patients back in. I thought, oh, you know, I've got 6 to 8 month lead time before that meeting. Is this going to be real easy? And it was, I didn't get nearly as many in as I wanted, and it just took longer. So we're going to continue that to try and have as much of the long-term data as possible.
Well, especially young people, right? If you're doing them when they're, let's say, teens or 20s, young people tend to move a lot. Whereas if you get someone who's, let's say, 40 or 50, probably going to stay put.
I know, and you hear all kinds of interesting things. Like, you know, you phone one person, they're like, oh, you know, unfortunately, he passed away.
Oh,
yeah. Another guy we phoned, he said, oh, he's in prison.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's the whole range of what happens to humans, right? When you're dealing with a few thousand cases, you're going to have the whole range of everything.
I mean, you're a good example, right? From your childhood years, you changed continents.
That's right. But I tell you what's really interesting. I've got a first cousin of mine that's an ophthalmologist in South Africa.
Okay.
And he's a few years older than me, and he was always the superstar in high school and the academic genius and everything. And Larry's a very, very good general ophthalmologist in South Africa. And he does some LASIK on the side.
Sure.
Right. But I mean, he does some LASIK on the side, right?
Right.
And he's good at it. But I mean, I probably do more LASIK in 1 month than he's done in a long, long time. But my family, when I go back, they still think of him as the expert in everything. So they've got LASIK issues. It's like, let's ask Larry.
Well, speaking of that,
this is family dynamics, right?
Yeah, that you can't change. Listen, I believe I have the same in my family. I promise, in my family, I am literally the Dumbo.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't ask him. He doesn't know anything. He's too
fair. Yeah, I was once cooking with my sister, and I got hot oil on my hand. I got a little scar here to prove it. And my mother and my sister, like, give me some butter. And they said, put butter on the burn.
Okay.
I'm like, what are you talking about? Give me some ice, like now. And they stand in front of the fridge. And I'm like, what are you doing? I need some ice now. And eventually I'm like, okay, who here is like a doctor? That's me. Yeah. Didn't make any difference.
Right.
Who here has actually worked in a burn unit? Oh, that's
right. Me. Right.
Like, didn't make any difference.
Too funny. Now, so there's a lot to learn from you. So you've done at least 10 times, if not more than that, LASIK than I have. You're certainly well over 100,000 cases done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is an incredible number. So there's, you know what, there's a lot I got to ask you. In fact, I made some notes here. I got to pick your brains here. you have an amazing, right, experience that very, very few surgeons have. Like, I've met very few surgeons have this kind of volume.
Yeah, I mean, this is my whole career, and I wanted to make sure that whatever I was doing, I was as good as I could possibly be and picked up all the nuances. And I've been super sensitive about not falling into the trap of falling into all the new technology. And I think actually out of all the things that we've done best in our clinic,
right?
Out of all the things, I think the thing that we've done best is actually make technology decisions. Because you know what it's like. It's so tempting when you go to Academy, you go to Ashworth, you go to other meetings, and you got somebody that's internationally renowned, people that you know, people that you love and you think you trust them,
right.
And they say, okay, corneal rings, best thing to come out. So I remember when that came out, when that first came out, it came out to treat myopia, not
right. As low degrees of myopia.
Yeah, not as a way to treat keratoconus. And I remember the data that came, if I remember correctly, it said something like 56% of the people are 2016 or better, and we've had to explant none of them.
Right.
All right, and I was in Atlanta, and there was one of the study sites was here, and I was like, well, yeah, we've seen some patients that needed to be explanted.
Yeah.
And then the way it turned out was that they had a 2-year follow-up, and then after the 2 years, a lot of them were explanted. Like in 2 years plus 6 months, they had a whole bunch that were explanted, right? And I think you've just got to be super careful. And I gave a lecture last night in Asheville to a bunch of optometrists, and that's one of the things I was really going on about is you've got to be really careful about getting the information even from your own like, kind of societies and even from people that are on the podium that are very, very well known. Because a lot of times there's industry influence.
Right.
That really, sure. that kind of, I think, even subconsciously guides people's decisions. And so, like, a lot of times when I give lectures, I'll put up a slide that's got 7 or 8 different corneas, like RK, HexK, corneal rings, camera, raindrop, CK,
LTK.
And it's got all of those in there. Yeah. And the one thing that I think we're most proud of in our perhaps, I mean, like, we like to think we're pretty good at doing LASIK, but there's a lot of good LASIK surgeons out there. Like, there's a lot of good cataract surgeons out there, right? And everyone likes to think, okay, Uday, you're the best cataract guy out there. But I'm sure even in LA, you'll say there's a lot of good cataract surgeons in LA, right?
Sure.
And same thing with LASIK. But one of the things we've done really well is with technology. Like, we didn't do a single eye on a single patient on a single one of those technologies.
Wow.
And we were tempted.
We were
really tempted.
Right.
Especially with camera, because a lot of our patients have got the money and they come in and say they want to help with presbyopia. And I had three friends that are ophthalmologists, and I'm not going to name them, but they all had it done on their own eyes. And they said, man, this is awesome. I even had it done on my wife's eyes. No problems. It's absolutely awesome. And we got really close to doing it. And then all of a sudden, like, one of them phoned me and he's like, Jonathan, well, you know, when I said it was perfect, it was perfect,
but no,
until it wasn't.
All right.
And I had to take those out of my wife's eyes. But we put another camera back in there and it's working just fine. And then, like, 6 months later, they'd take that one out as well. And so we got close. And some of that was dumb luck. And some of it was, I think, you know, we had our little core group together and we all had to be on board before we brought new technology.
Right.
And I think Dr. Stolzen was a good influence on that as well. But it's easy to get tempted by the bright, new, sparkly things. Because, you know, we had, like, referring doctors phoning us saying, hey, dude, you know, you need to be offering this. Your competitors are offering it. Why aren't you? Are you scared to do new technology? Are you, like, what's the deal? And so there's a certain amount of pressure there. And you want to keep patients happy. You want to keep your referring doctors happy. And you also want the financial part of it as well. But first, I think you've got to put, you know, you've got to put patients first.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you've seen the whole progression. You've seen, because you've been doing this for so long, you've seen from, gosh, broad beam lasers.
Yeah.
And microcatheters where you actually have to push, right? Like ACS.
Well, the old ACS was definitely a challenge, and
then the Hansatome,
you know, and I always remember Steve Slade showing that video that he used to show when he lectured of if you didn't put the foot plate in correctly, instead of having 160 micron, you'd have a like 2000 micron flap. In other words, you're entering the AC under high pressure,
right.
And he used to show this video of someone, not him, doing the procedure, and you'd see like the lens flying out of the eye after they entered it, and or a bunch of fluid coming out of the eye. And then you always labeled it. He was like, because he was, you know, obviously Steve was or is in Houston.
Right.
And so his tagline was, Houston, we have a problem.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. But the ACSs were difficult. But everything changes. So, you know, we still do some keratome cases.
Right.
And you know, the femtos have gotten so much better and easier to use, and the keratomes also gotten somewhat better as well.
Yeah, I think the next generation are going to have combined in one box femto plus eczema.
Yeah. That's the word. Is the new Alcon will hopefully have both in. From what I'm hearing, that's still a few years away from coming to market.
Now, in your practice, because you do so much of this, what percent of the LASIK patients have gone to doing lenticule or smile?
We're not doing much smile. We aren't doing
either.
More. A smile sounded good, and I think if it had been competing with RK or competing with another technology, it would have done awesome.
Right.
But when it's competing with LASIK, it's a tough call. I think if you've got some patients with really bad dry eye, then you can make a case for it. I'm not sure that it's really holding that much weight right now.
Yeah,
and especially now, because the lasers, the lasers have gotten better. Our nomograms have gotten better. Software is better. And the results are just, I mean, they're just insane. I mean, it's so rare to find a post-op day one that's not 2015 or better. I mean,
right.
And so that's very hard to compete with the new technology. And so we haven't done a lot with SMILE, but we are doing more ICLs.
Sure.
So we've brought our bar down. It used to be, hey, you know, we'd do LASIK up into 12.
Mm-hmm.
And now for rare cases, we still may do that, but they better make sure that they're not an ICL candidate. All right, they're going to have really, really low ACDs, and or they just don't want to pay for it. But we pretty much don't do any LASIK over 8 or 10 right now.
Yeah, same.
And anyone over 6, we're talking to them about ICLs. Or anyone over 6, we talk about it. Anyone over 8, we say, this is what you need. You really need to have ICLs.
Now, how do you kind of change that psychology? The patient comes in expecting LASIK, and now you're proposing something totally different. How do you...
That is a super, super good question, because that's something that we deal with a lot and we talk about a lot, because what you risk, and it's happened several times, that you start talking about these other options and now they start to think, okay, now I'm not a good LASIK candidate. You want me to do something else, and it's going to be
twice the price,
50, 60, 80% more money.
Yeah.
And they're like, all right, he's just trying to upsell me or something. It's not an easy transition. And I don't profess to have that completely figured out,
right?
Because no one likes to be upsold and stuff. And we really made a real effort to prepare patients beforehand. And so one of the things that we've done, and we saw that from was it Dr. Green from Australia about the videos that he was talking about. Anyway, we've done a lot of work with making videos. The patients.
Oh, or David Gunn.
Yeah, David Gunn. That's right. Thank you. And he was talking about using AI for it. So we've done a little bit with AI, but we did it before AI was really able to do that really easily. And so we made very intricate videos that patients get before they see the surgeon.
Right.
And that way, and so in that video, we can talk about, hey, if you, there may be some of the options we talk about. And I think that has helped a lot. And then before I see patients, they see this video that's like, it's pretty long. It's like 27 minutes. Okay. But it covers everything. And so when I see patients, I say, have you seen the video? And it's almost always yes. And I stop. I say, great. I have nothing new to tell you that's significant. But I'm going to go over certain things, take questions, tell you about surgery, and we'll rock and roll.
Sure.
So I think getting patients educated before they see the doctor is critical. And that holds true, you know, for your work as well with cataracts, right? I mean, you don't want patients coming in thinking they're getting cataract surgery that's covered by insurance or Medicare. And then they're told, yeah, that's true, but
right,
what you really want is this multifocal, yeah, and it's going to cost you $5,000 an eye or $4,000 an eye, whatever. And so in our experience, we found that, you know, that's when patients start to give pushback if they're hearing about it at that last minute. It's a lot easier if they've heard about it beforehand, saying, hey, you're going to get your consult with Uday, and he's going to make sure you're a good candidate. And there's some really, you know, cool technology out there that can help you treat astigmatism and close, blah, blah, blah. You know the whole scoop. But if they hear about it beforehand, then I think that it's a different kind of discussion that you have. I mean, how do you deal with it with your patients?
Well, we send them the same thing. They get an email with a link to a video that they're supposed to watch before they come in. It's about 20 minutes long. When they come in, we ask, hey, did you see the video? If they didn't, we give them an iPad and some headphones.
Yeah, that's what we do as well, yeah.
And then here you go, watch the video. Because then it also saves me from repeating the same thing over and over again. If I have to go the whole day and tell 20 patients the exact same script,
you'll end up like making it shorter and shorter, right, and shorter, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they can also go back and watch it multiple times. Sometimes they didn't understand quite what you said, but in the video, they can rewind it, pause it, watch it again.
Great. I think it helps a little bit with marketing, because I get patients every week that say, I sent your video or your link to someone else. Because, you know, I try to keep it a little bit lighthearted. And I have had a couple of patients that said they didn't like it because the language wasn't always totally clean through the whole thing.
Yeah. I've had very positive feedback from it. And then again, they're able to ask me then very specific questions, and I don't have to go over just the basics. But I think that's an important way of doing it. But
yeah, I think, you know, in general, we live in an economy where there's just upselling wherever you go, right? And we try to want to stay away from that, because people are really kind of giving an awful lot of pushback on being surprised at the last minute,
right,
at extra expenses. And so you want to try and avoid that as much as possible.
Well, in fact, I do the opposite in my video. I just said at the beginning, if you're happy with your current vision and you think you see great, Then if it's not broken, don't fix it. You don't need to do cataract surgery now. See us in a year.
Yeah.
And so I talked right off the bat. Like, I'm not here. I'm truly not here to sell any patient anything. Yeah. If you want me to help you, I'm here to help you. And I tell them also, I like to cook dinner for someone who's hungry. I like to do surgery for someone who wants surgery. If you don't want surgery, I'm good.
But that's, and I try, when we hire new surgeons, I try to impress that on them. But it's a lot easier to do that when you're in your situation, my situation, where you've got a lot of surgery to begin with. Right. And you're not going to miss the two or three or five patients that decide, okay, I'll just wait a year because he told me, they're hearing it different. They're hearing, he told me I don't need it, which is not what you said, but that's what they're hearing.
Right.
And they decide not to do surgery. You're not going to miss that in your numbers or your financials because you know, it's really. But when you're starting out,
every case counts.
Every case counts, and it's definitely more difficult. And it's really hard to impress the importance of that on the younger surgeons, I think. But that's how you're going to make your reputation at the beginning. And the way I did it on the LASIK side was, I've always had an optometrist do the consults before me. And there are a few reasons for that. Number one is that I really don't like flipping dials and doing refractions. I really, really don't like doing that. And number two, for time issues, it takes, to counsel the patients properly, it takes time. But then also, there was also an element of, I didn't want even my subconscious to be pushing patients towards surgery that didn't need it. And the very, very early days of LASIK, we were still trying to figure out who was getting ataxia and why, and there was a problem. But once we figured that out, then it became really important to be able to say, we need to stay away from that. And when Dr. Stalting joined us, he had that Randleman was his fellow at the time, that Randleman risk score scale that has had a mixed reaction in the community because it's fairly conservative. But we found it works really well.
Sure. And
it also standardizes the decision making, so that different doctors in different places are making the same decisions. It was important for someone else to be making the decision. So I wasn't pushing someone towards surgery that they didn't need. Sure. If someone's on the borderline, those doctors were tasked with, hey, if they're borderline, just say no. You're saying, I want to cook for someone that's hungry. I love that line. I'm going to be using that. but I do like to actually physically cook.
Right.
And bake. And you want to cook for people that appreciate your cooking. I get it. Right.
Well, there's so much psychology in what we do. In fact, one of the things, I got a question for you. You do this all the time. You get the patient who literally is 20/20. And they say, I know, but it doesn't seem that sharp. When's it going to be really sharp? How do you even deal with that?
So listen, as a refractive surgeon, we deal with that every day, right?
Right.
And so first of all, the best way to deal with it is to deal with it up front, before the surgery.
Okay.
Saying, listen, this is not going to be, number one, it's not going to be exactly perfect. And our idea is to make you 20 happy, not 20 perfect.
Yeah.
So deal with that before. And then also the important thing is to tell them not to compare the eyes.
Right, of course.
All right, and that's in my video as well. Don't compare the other eyes. And actually, that's one of the areas where my language gets a little colorful in there, because I say, hey, listen, don't compare the two eyes, because if you do, Dr. Wolfson's going to kick your ass. Right? And everyone laughs about it, but they remember it. All right. And so it wasn't like random that I was using kind of edgy language. It's there for a reason, because everyone remembers it afterwards. So then post-op, if the patient's 20/20 saying it's a little blurry, we'll say, hey, listen, we talked about it wasn't going to be perfect, remember? We talked about not comparing the two eyes. Are you comparing the two eyes? And I'm kind of comparing the two eyes. Okay, so first let's stop that. And then the way I always word it is I say something like, hey, if this is bugging you a little bit and you're thinking about it once in a while and it irritates you some, then just leave it alone. But if it's more than that and it bugs the crap out of you and you're thinking about it every hour of every day, now the benefit has now risen. Right, because maybe they've got plus a quarter, minus three quarters, or something. So they're eking out a 20/20 squinting a little, whatever it is, but that still is giving them a little bit of problems. And so, if it's bugging you that much, then we do it. But I tell them, hey, we can make this worse.
Right.
And so what the really interesting one comes up is if you got that kind of patient, and they've got three quarters of a unit of sill, maybe a back of sill. Division's still really good, and they want an enhancement. But now let's say they're 5 years out.
Okay.
What do you do?
I don't know. Do you lift or do you PRK over the flap?
Well, that's the point, is that you really want to do a PRK on a plus a quarter, minus three quarters. Because you can have a PRK have the numbers perfect, and you can end up like with a minus one or something. Just something totally wacky.
Yeah.
Now, usually if that happens, if you let it sit for a year, the epithelium will remold and you generally will be okay, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so you're tempted to go back and lift those flaps. And I did that actually a couple of weeks ago. Because I had a patient that was an engineer, super type A, had a little bit of sill. He was 21 years out.
Wow.
And he had developed a buck of sill, and he was 25 plus uncorrected. And I was like, I'm not sure I'm trusting this to PRK, especially short term, because he could be miserable for several months.
Right.
So, and you know, we showed the data is that you can lift the flaps no problem, and you can do the surgery no problem. Your real problem there is that they have a much higher incidence of ingrowth.
Yeah, have the ingrowth.
Yeah, and so I just had him sign that off saying, listen, the ingrowth we can deal with if we have to.
Right.
And I wrote it out, and I had him actually sign it so he knows that it's an increased risk. And we lifted the flap. And so I'll make exceptions to that rule, the two-year rule, depending on the patient.
Right. I have a good line for that. I said, well, first, your eyes are sisters, not identical twins.
I'm learning something here too. I like this.
When you do the cover one eye, cover the other, back and forth, I said, that's bad for the brain. It prevents the brain from syncing the two images. Don't ever do that.
Yeah, I talk about that as well. You're going to get patients to understand it's a brain issue, not an eye issue.
Right, right. And that's it. When you listen, do you ever compare one ear to the other, stick a finger in one ear? No. Well, then don't do it for your eyes. So, I mean, I think so much of what we do really is ends up being that psychology, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you said, if you end up kind of your things where like you under-promise, tell them ahead of time, and then you hopefully over-deliver, that difference is the happiness.
Yeah, and I think it was one of the ODs at TLC coined that term once about being 20 happy.
Right.
And that means different things for different people. And I think on the cataract end, there's a little bit more leeway because patients are coming in with more functional problems.
Right.
They've got more. They've got blurriness. They've got glare. They've got something wrong. Right. You know, on the LASIK side, as you know, patients are coming in with exquisite vision, and they, no matter what they say, I don't care what they say, they will expect that perfect vision afterwards.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, the cataract patients have one more beauty. I said, if you keep complaining, I tell them jokingly, if you keep complaining, I'll put the cataract back in your eye. And then they're like, okay, I get it. It's you know,
but well, I actually say the same thing as with the laser. I say, I'll put the laser, or I'll take the laser out of your eye. You can do that. I'm like, no, I'm just kidding. Okay, don't take the laser out of the eye.
Are there some patients in your clinic, let's say, where you look at them ahead of time, and what are your kind of key points of like, you know what, you're not a good laser cataract? We talk about one, which is too high of a refractive error. Now, maybe is there something you look at on every patient, let's say epithelial maps, if they're very thin at the apex, or if you look at patients who have, let's say, some irregularity, what's your kind of cutoff? We talked a little bit about the Randleman criteria, but that's on the obviously on the conservative side. Do you vary from that?
We will vary from it on very rare occasions. I mean, it's only a few times a year that we will. And so here, and it could vary going both ways. So let's say you have a young patient, a 20-year-old, that's got PACs of 5/10.
Okay.
They're a minus two with perfect penicams. Are you going to do LASIK on that patient?
Sounds pretty reasonable.
And I agree with you, it is. But if you put that on the Randleman scale, there's a point system. If you get 4 points, we don't do LASIK. So you've got to get less than 4 points to get cleared for LASIK. And as a 20-year-old, you're getting 3 points off the bat.
For being young.
Yeah. For being young. And having PACs of 5/10, you're getting 2 points right there.
So you're already out.
So you're already out, even if everything else is perfect. And so in those cases, I'll say to patients, just tell them the truth. Say, we use the scale. The scale is saying you shouldn't get LASIK. But if you were my family member, I would do LASIK on you. I'm going to give you the option of PRK or LASIK. If you get LASIK, you know, the scale is saying there's a high risk of the ectasia. We discussed that. And we'll follow you every year. And then we put them on a program where we actually follow their pentacams every year to make sure that. And that way, I feel like we're doing the best thing for the patient. And we're informing them and we're letting them make the decision and having them sign off on it.
Yeah,
and so far we haven't got burned doing that. And now the reverse is also true because, you know, the one thing that has some level of subjectivity in the decision making, even in the Randleman scale, is the IS ratio.
Okay.
And so the IS ratio itself is just a number and that's not subjective. But sometimes you look at a map and you're saying, yeah, the IS ratio is fine. It doesn't fit the clear criteria for keratoconus or pellucid, but it just looks a little funky. Like it's just got something that's starting to look like a little bit of a wraparound maybe, but it's just so mild. It doesn't hit the criteria for being having any diagnosis.
Sure.
And so in those cases, we'll do the opposite. The patient may be cleared for LASIK on the scale, but I just make the call on the topography and say abnormal topography. And there is actually a space on the Randleman scale for that. And I'll just say that's abnormal. Even though the IS ratio is fine, right. I can't put a specific name on it. It just looks hinky.
Yeah.
And especially if they're young. And I think that combination of younger age and topos that are not perfect, and I think that's the combination that's most dangerous for ectasia.
Right. For the young patient, same with me. Young patient, a little bit funny topography or tomography. I'll say, you know what? You may be a cat of the future, but we're not doing anything now. Let's just check your back in a year and another year. And let's just see, is there change over time? And then, but I said, you may be a cat of the future, but just don't do it now.
Yeah. But and what I tell other surgeons is that whatever you decide to do, you don't have to use, you know, the same scale, the Randleman scale that we do. But whatever it is, make sure it's some system and you're using it consistently and it's had some level of vetting outside of your own clinic.
For sure.
So that you can just say, listen, this is the system we use. It's been acknowledged by some outside parties.
Right.
There's some people use a percentage of the cornea, how much you remove, right?
Sure.
But whatever the system is, outside people have put a stamp of approval on it and we use it and it cleared that system and we got ectasia and that sucks. Because we have found, I think over the course of time, we've got two patients now that got LASIK and would have and did clear the system.
Mm.
Right. And one was, and you wonder like what happened because one was a young patient, 20-year-old that was, I remember it very well. She had packs of 512. She was a minus 250 and everything looked great.
Sure.
Pentacam was perfect and she got ectasia. And you look back on that and you say, well, we would continue. And that even cleared the Randleman scale. We would do LASIK on that every day.
All right.
And so you wonder what happened. So none of these scales are perfect. But you want to have something that has been vetted and something that you're using consistently.
For sure. I think that's very important to kind of be consistent with this. But yeah, there are always those patients. I mean, these rare things happen, but when you do enough volume, you're going to see them.
Yeah.
Right? Essentially, like every, God, I don't know how I got so lucky, but every cataract surgeon, at some point, you may get an endophthalmitis. No matter your best efforts, no matter what you do. In the USA every year, it's a rate of like 1 in 2,000 eyes, believe it or not. It's a huge number.
True. Yeah. Okay.
That's the Academy's most recent.
Yeah.
So you just gotta. I mean, rare things happen rarely, but if you don't have volume, you'll
so
see
what
it.
Do you think? So you're knocking your head. Does that mean you've never had an endophthalmitis?
By some miracle, yeah.
Really? Wow. So I don't really believe that it's random. Okay. So if you were to guess, because you don't know, but if you had a, you know, pontificate about what you think the reason is, either for you or for some surgeons or even some surgery centers, because our rate in our surgery center is way less than 1 in 2,000.
Sure.
And we have, you know, four main surgeons using it. What do you think are the most important criteria that are keeping you away from trouble?
Well, I mean, the big studies have shown we're doing certainly preservative-free moxifloxacin inside the anterior chamber at the end of the case. So that's one very important thing. The other thing is I'm absolutely meticulous about draping. I don't have any lash in the field because, right, the source of your endophthalmitis is your own flora from your eyelashes, your eyelids. Okay. We have great draping. We use a tegaderm, cut in half, and the drape goes around the lid margin.
Yeah.
The instruments are obviously sterilized fresh for every case. I mean, every time I use instruments, if I'm moving fast, they may even be warm. The instruments can be literally warm in my hands because they just came out of the sterilizer. And then I think probably the best thing that's been shown in big studies is the prophylaxis with an antibiotic in the anterior chamber at the end of the case. You achieve a sufficiently high dose that you basically clean out the entire anterior chamber. And we get lucky there. And then the patients who have, if there's a problem patient where you're going to get seeding in the vitreous, let's say really bad zonulopathy where you get flow of BSS into the anterior eyelid face, or let's say there's a capsule rupture, we know that's a 10x risk for endophthalmitis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I use the same thing. I use the tegaderm for LASIK, and right. I also fold around the superior lashes anyway.
LASIK, that's a habit because back when we're using these microkeratomes, like you're using the Hansatome, boy, if there's one lash that gets in that track, you're cooked. So you got to get those lashes out of the way completely.
Yeah, yeah. And the Hansatome had a tendency to nick the lid anyway.
Yeah.
I never liked that.
I had a trick for that too. As I'm doing it, I'd put my two fingers, index finger and middle finger, on the speculum with the other hand, and I'd push the speculum into the orbit, proptose the eye a little bit, and so push the lash, everything out of the way.
So is there anything else, like during cataract surgery with the wound construction or at the end of the case?
I'm meticulous with the wound. So I only use the diamond keratome. I like to barely nick the limbal vessels. And so because that gives great long-term sealing, a truly avascular phaco incision, you can open it a year later for an IOL exchange with a spatula. It's like a LASIK flap.
Yeah.
You can easily open it. But if I barely nick the limbal vessels, like in LASIK, if you had a flap that hits some little corner, you can't lift it. So I want that. And then I also, the construction of my incision, I have a sufficiently good tunnel length. And I don't overly hydrate at the end of the case. I do some hydration just to the roof of the incision, not the lateral walls. And then at the end there, it has to be absolutely bone dry when I check it. And if it's not, I don't mind put a 10-0 in. 10-0 nylon, my friend.
How often are you doing that?
Way less than 1% of the time.
Okay, so it's not often. Okay.
But I'm super consistent with my diamond keratome, the way I make an incision. I'm super, super consistent. I do it so much, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the key. So then all these things together kind of, reduce your risk there. Like you, though, every surgery I do, I want to give the same treatment that I'd want to receive. So if it's me having surgery, I want to be draped this way. I want this kind of prep. I want this type of incision. I want you to hit my limbal vessels. I want you to put some moxifloxacin in my, everything that I'd want in my eye, I give to my patients. So they don't even have to think about it.
And how many different ASCs do you work at? Do you just at one or more than one?
Now one. In the past, I used to work way harder. Okay. In the past, I used to operate at 3-4 locations around LA, drive a lot. You know how it is. When you're in your 30s, even 40s, you're just lean and thirsty and hungry and working hard. And I just can't anymore. So now I just do one location. I actually do less volume now than I've done in years prior. You get to a point where it's like in yours, you could run your huge empire of 13 clinics. But it's just sometimes better to hire someone, hire a CEO, COO, hire someone who can do this. So just because at some point, which I didn't understand until I hit 50, that number one, presbyopia is real. Now that I have presbyopia, I believe. And number two, like, I'm definitely on the second half of life, and my most valuable asset is time. Yeah. That's what I want to prioritize, is enjoying time. Like when the lecture in South Africa, let me also spend a few days in safari and enjoy life.
Yeah. And there was a good few days.
That was amazing. What a beautiful. If you're an American listening, but most of our audience is American, highly recommend that meeting. South Africa's cataract surgery.
When I was giving the C lecture last night to the optometrist, I interjected a bunch of the safari slides. I just did a bunch of case studies for them. And at the end of every case study, I put in a couple of safari slides. And I think they were more interested in the safari slides than my lecture.
Yeah, I can't blame them. That's just truly, truly magic. Well, can you imagine, Jonathan, we've been talking for an hour already. Time flies.
Wow. Yeah.
So again, I want to thank you for this podcast. It's really fantastic. A lot of great discussion, a lot of learning. And see, I told you, nothing to prepare ahead of time. We just have a fun conversation.
You're right. Very cool.
All right. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cattery Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Cattery Coach podcast. Plus, of course, you have a new Cattery Coach video every single day, 2,900 and counting. And of course, we now have our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com, with Retina videos and Retina podcasts. So until next time, I'll catch you later.